You are listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 23rd of January, 2012, on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, live from Monocle 24's Studio One. I'm Nancy Durham, here with you over the next hour, and what a collection of stories we have. We're going to talk body language and try to find out why North Korea's new leader holds hands with his military escorts. The master of suspense, Alfred Hitchcock, also produced some masterly silent films. We'll talk about an attempt to resurrect them. London's South Bank is tackling the subject of death. A new exhibition uses poetry, music, comedy, and trendy coffins to try to, in their words, get the most out of death. And our foreign editor, Steve Bloomfield, will be here with a review of our new edition of Monocle magazine, right here on Midori House, on Monocle 24. First, let's get the latest news from around the world with Nick Kelly.
Monocle 24 News, I'm Nick Kelly. France, Britain and Germany have said they were willing to negotiate with Iran if it was ready to talk seriously about its nuclear program, hours after the European Union imposed an oil embargo and sanctions on Iran's central bank. A joint statement said, "We call on Iran's leadership immediately to suspend its sensitive nuclear activities and abide fully by its international obligations." The statement said Iran continued to show disregard for its international obligations and was exporting and threatening violence across the region. Britain's Foreign Secretary William Hague insists sanctions are appropriate.
Iran continues to defy UN Security Council resolutions and enriches uranium to 20% at COM, for which there is no plausible civilian explanation.
The Obama administration applauded Europe's decision to slap new sanctions on Iran and said the United States and its international partners were committed to preventing Tehran from acquiring nuclear weapons. Syria has rebuffed as a conspiracy an Arab League call for President Bashar al-Assad to step down in favor of a unity government to calm a 10-month-old revolt in which thousands of Syrians have been killed. The Lebanese Foreign Minister Adnan Mansour criticised the League's move, saying its ministers had taken an unbalanced approach to the crisis by disregarding violence perpetrated by Assad's opponents. Qatar's Prime Minister Hamad bin Jassim Al Thani laid out the Arab League's conditions.
To form a unity government within 2 months and to study an agreeable personality to head this government and to arrange for political and elections to be supervised by the Arab League.
A top Kremlin aide said today Moscow could do little more for President Assad, opening the door to a shift in Russia's position. Moscow is one of Assad's few remaining allies, resisting pressure to call for his resignation and with China blocking a Western-crafted UN Security Council resolution that would have condemned a crackdown that's killed thousands of civilians. Fighters loyal to ousted Libyan leader Muammar Gaddafi are in control of the town of Bani Walid, about 200 kilometres southeast of the capital, after attacking a pro-government militia base there. The Gaddafi supporters were flying green flags in the town, a symbol of allegiance to the ousted administration. Divers have found two more bodies on the capsized cruise liner resting half-submerged near the port of Italy's Giglio Island. The bodies were found on deck number 4 of the Costa Concordia. The recovery brings the total number of bodies now found to 15. Croatia's accession to the European Union next year was hailed by EU foreign ministers today. Croatia is now set to become the EU's 28th member on July the 1st, 2013. EU Commission President José Manuel Barroso said Croatia's accession was good news for Europe.
Croatia's upcoming accession is also a clear signal to the rest of Southeastern Europe that European Union membership is within reach and that reforms pay off.
Finally, the landmark clock tower containing Big Ben at Britain's Palace of Westminster is tilting, while media reports today said the mother of all parliaments was slipping into the River Thames, raising fears over its future. The House of Commons Commission, which is responsible for the upkeep of the 19th century neo-Gothic parliamentary estate, popular with tourist photographs, was due to meet today to discuss the situation. Those are the top stories here on Monocle 24.
Thank you. Thank you, Nick. Nice to see you after a bit of a while. And Big Ben.
Yes. That's tilting to the left, but don't read any politics into that.
And even under this administration, must be the coalition.
Yes.
Thank you very, very much. Okay, you are listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. And now we have a chance to find out about the global weather outlook with Tomasz Szafranaker.
The weather, in association with Kuoni Travel.
In Western Europe, fairly mild weather at the moment, and that's how it's going to stay over the coming days. A breeze, cloud and some Atlantic rain for the UK, France and Germany. Rain also across the East Mediterranean, the Greek islands. So where's the cold, snowy January weather? Well, it's of course in Scandinavia and the far east of Europe. The Alps will also be getting some snow Tuesday night. Here's Tuesday's city forecast. London, 8 Celsius and rain. Paris, 8 degrees with some evening rain. Zurich, 4 with rain showers. And in Helsinki, it's minus 1 and it'll be snowing. How about North America? Well, from Chicago to New England and the Big Apple, as well as Washington, D.C., it's a fairly rainy start to the business week. A little snow in places too, but it's about to turn sunnier and milder as we go into Tuesday. So here is Tuesday's city forecast. In New York City, 7 Celsius with some sunshine. In Philadelphia, 11 degrees and sunny. Chicago, 0, partly cloudy. Los Angeles, 20 Celsius and mostly sunny. And in L.A., it's really going to warm up this week, up to 25 or 26 degrees by Thursday, almost like summer. Other world destinations now, in Japan and Tokyo, the next day or two, a lot of cloudy weather, some rain too, highs of only 6 degrees with chilly evenings. In China, Hong Kong, cool, cloudy, a rain chance too, only 11 degrees in Hong Kong, the January average is more like 18. And in Singapore, 30 Celsius with tropical showers. And on that contrasting note, that's it from me. I'm meteorologist Tomasz Szafranaker here on Monocle 24.
That's right. Thank you, Tomasz. And you are listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
Vous écoutez Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Dette Monocle 24.
Esse Monocle 24.
Das ist Monocle 24.
Ein Monocle 24 Lagatja.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Monocle 24 e io cosa?
Tama on Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
You're listening to Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Well, it comes to us all, but it is so, so difficult to accept and deal with, at least for most people. We're talking about death, and London's South Bank Centre is taking on the subject, promising to defy taboos and examine what it calls this unknowable certainty. Well, I'm delighted to welcome the exhibition's curator, Paul Denton, into our studio, very much alive.
Hello, thank you.
Why have you taken on this downer of a topic?
Well, the South Bank Centre deals with various festivals throughout its programme across the year. This is just a weekend that celebrates something which is, as you said, the inevitable truth. It all happens at some point. And it's about tackling that in a different light to celebrate the living. It's a festival for the living, so it celebrates how we can prepare for the certainty.
And one of the things, well, let's go, so you're gone, you're dead, it's over for you, no more fear, etc.
Yes.
It's for your friends, your relations to deal with you. There's a body, you have to dispose of it. Some people are going to be cremated. You, I understand, are an expert in coffins, and not just any old coffin, but some pretty over-the-top ones.
Yeah, as part of the festival, we've got boxed fabulous coffins from the UK and Ghana is its title. So we've got three coffins, which are Ghanaian coffins, which are artworks on loan from the Jack Bell Gallery. And the rest of the coffins are from Vic Ferns Limited, a company based in Nottingham, where you can commission your own bespoke coffin and have whatever you want. So in the exhibition, we've got a large corkscrew, a Rolls Royce, an aeroplane, a ballet shoe, even a skip, which are these things, the items that people want to put personality into their funeral. So,
see, I'm one of those people who, like, I don't want to get into the box.
Yeah.
I don't want this to happen. I'm in denial or something. But what sort of person decides, okay, I'm going to go in a corkscrew? Well, I'm maybe somebody who likes a bottle of wine, obviously.
Of course, a wine
connoisseur. What sort of person needs to, you know, care so much about what they're parked in when it's over?
I think it's the same as people prepare for weddings and make it to a massive celebration. A funeral is a celebration. It's to celebrate that life rather than just a morbid day. It's about celebrating that person, having that individuality into your funeral. So lots of the people that have actually commissioned the coffins are coming to the festival itself and will stand by their coffin and do tours, and they can talk about it. One gentleman who was an aeronautical engineer commissioned the aeroplane. He worked on Concorde and some of the Boeing planes. He went to his local crematorium, got it measured, came back, got the design together and realised that the wings would have to come off if it was to go into the crematorium before it was burnt. So he made all those plans and worked with the company that was fabricating the coffin.
So he actually does have an airplane-shaped coffin.
Yes, it's an airplane. And with its fuselage, with its wings.
Have you been in it? Did you try it?
No. I think some of the coffins are displayed open, so you can see the interior, but no one's actually sat in them as yet.
And what's he got, like a sort of a nice seat that folds back or something that he'll be lying down in?
It's a sort of long shape. So, I mean, it's, as you would imagine, a coffin, but just shaped as an aeroplane. Another gentleman had an Orient Express carriage because his fondest memories have been with his wife travelling on the Orient Express. And so that was a bespoke design that he wanted with some illustrations on the side of him and his wife in the carriage. So they're quite beautiful things. I mean, obviously, some people are shocked that we're displaying something like the coffin because it's such a sort of an iconic image of death. But in this way, it really brings to life the personality of the person that's chosen it and commissioned it.
Christopher Hitchens, the celebrated polemicist who just died very, very recently, yes, decided no funeral for me. He was against the terribly expensive way of death. And so in protest, he gave over his much used body to medical science, yes, to have a look at. And what do you say about that? Because these kinds of coffins you're describing must be very expensive. And
It's different price ranges. I know the Ghanaian coffins are almost like a year's salary for some of the coffins. They're hugely expensive for the people out there. But it's part of the culture where to celebrate the life, these coffins are made as a celebration of that. So the ones here, obviously, there's bespoke coffins. We've had some eco coffins that sort of dispose in the ground. So people have requested those kind of coffins.
Like a basket or something like
exactly.
that?
Exactly. There's a beautiful one in the exhibition of an egg. A lady wanted to be buried in the fetal position. So it's a beautiful oak veneered egg.
Trying to start all over again.
Yes.
What about you? Have you got one? Have you got your eye on one?
I'm not sure.
When you're young, people can't see you. You're what? Are you 30-something, maybe?
30s,
maybe.
Yes. Yeah. Yes.
Okay, so you've got a while, presumably. Yes. But has this made you think about what you'd like to
that kind of that kind of celebration? I'm an artist as well, so I'd probably have a large paintbrush or some such thing. As part of the exhibition as well, we've got lots of events going on surrounding. It's the 27th to the 29th of January it runs. On the Friday night, we've got Paul Gambaccini spinning his Desert Island Death Discs, so people's favourite funeral songs to come down to. So it's that kind of interesting mix of what that means, why people have chosen certain songs and why they would request it as part of their last their last voice.
How has it been for you being part of this? I mean, you know something about the coffin business already, yes, the artistic coffin business, yes, but has this helped you in any way to feel better about death, or are you one of these people who isn't too bothered anyway?
Yeah, I'm not too bothered. I mean, the South Bank Centres, we've handled it very sensitively. We're having a marketplace during the festival where we're having Samaritans and other places where people can come, and it's not just about the fun side. It's also we've got that element where people can discuss and really come to terms with different elements to do with death. So there's a whole broad range of activity across the weekend that makes you think about different elements of death and dying. But it doesn't have to just be that morbid thing. It can be a celebration.
And I agree. I mean, the more you do talk about it and think about it, somehow it can get easier or more comfortable. Yet throughout the millennia, people we're still talking about it, trying to crack it, and I guess we never will.
Exactly, yes. I mean, funerals we see now are still black and sombre occasions, but these coffins, for example, are an amazing insight into that it can be a colourful occasion.
So selfless gesture, cheer yes, everybody up by yes, hopping into your aircraft
exactly,
or whatever. Okay,
yes,
I'll have to think about that. Paul Denton from the South Bank Centre, thank you very much for dropping by.
Thank you.
And now it's time for a song. This one's called Lose It, but I don't think it's death connected, and it's by Ostra.
Another older by the thumbs, the other.
That was Ostra with Lose It. Coming up on Midori House, Alfred Hitchcock's films, not his talkies, but the silent ones he made.
The February issue of Monocle has a warm glow as we look at how charm adds longevity to brands, makes offices great places to work, and keeps people returning to the same restaurants year after year. But there's more.
In the culture section, our man in Tokyo, Kenji Hall, wandered around the corner to Daikanyama's hottest new retail experience, Tsutaya. I jumped on the Eurostar to visit Air making their new album, La Voyage dans la Lune, and there's four cracking album reviews, more of which you can hear on Monocle 24.
Plus, there's our Japan travel survey, a visit to a jail-turned-craft school in Charleston, a neighbourhood to call home in Stockholm, and a rugged tale from Tehran. The February issue of Monocle is on newsstands now or available via subscription at monocle.com. Monocle, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
You are listening to Midori House on Monocle 24 with me, Nancy Durham. The British Film Institute has a major campaign underway to restore Alfred Hitchcock's silent films. It's called Rescue the Hitchcock Nine. One supporter of the project is director Martin Scorsese, who says, quote, Hitchcock is an enduring influence on world cinema, and his work must be available in the best possible prints. Well, with us now, and to help us understand why this is important, is Brian Robinson of the British Film Institute, and I welcome you here to Studio One.
Thank you.
Why is it important to make sure these nine films are preserved?
Well, Hitchcock is universally acknowledged as one of the world's greatest filmmakers. He comes top in polls whenever they're done for best films, best directors, particularly the Sight and Sound poll that we do every 10 years, which is kind of one of an industry standard. But Hitchcock has an enduring appeal and is adored by people who love cinema. But if you were talking about art and you couldn't see a Michelangelo or a Leonardo, it was displayed in a cracked, dirty print, you'd think that's not really respectful to the artist. And the same is true of Hitchcock's early works. He was born in 1899. His first film was The Pleasure Garden in 1925. And from 1925 to 1929, he made 10 films. Nine of which survive, one that he made in Germany, The Mountain Eagle, is lost, which we're actively looking for, but nothing's been really heard of it since 1930. So what we've got is a unique moment in the history of cinema and digital.
To preserve them.
To preserve them.
And there's so much to talk about here, but tell me something about the films. You've seen some of them. I'm loaded with questions, and we just need to hear from you. But is there a precursor of North by Northwest and Dial M for Murder in those films?
The wonderful thing about watching a silent Hitchcock film is that you suddenly find yourself seeing the Hitchcock signature. Suspense, a narrative that's being played out in just in images. It's so cinematic and so powerful. And if people have an idea that films made in the 1920s are old and scratchy and run at the wrong speed, nothing could be further than the truth. Once you see a proper silent film with music and also run at the right speed and in a good print so it looks as fresh and clear and pristine as if it was printed yesterday, then you really want more. And something like The Lodger, A Tale of the London Fog, which is a suspense murder film, a guy walks into a room and you think, he's the murderer, oh my God. And it's just through looking at eyes and the way that you see his feet first, there's a shadow. There's even a scene during a murder where you almost get the sensation that you hear a scream. But you can't because it's a silent film. But such is the emotional impact. And Hitchcock can make you feel as if you are hearing dialogue, but you really understand the story.
Do we see Hitchcock? Does he make any of his, you know, subtle appearances?
Oh, yes. His cameos start. And actually, the very first film that he directed, instead of it being the words Alfred Hitchcock, it's his signature. So he had a really intense sense of his own importance as a director. He was always very careful in controlling the publicity right the way through. And the wonderful thing we were saying about, do you see bits of Hitchcock later? You really can in these young works. But he was hailed as a genius.
But
with
physically
his second
see
film.
Him, like walking across the screen.
Yeah,
or
you physically see him. He's sitting in an underground car, or a tram, playing with a little girl and getting annoyed with her. Yeah, he's in quite a few of them.
So perhaps more involved in those films than later, because later on the game was, did you see him walk across the room in the background, right?
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's always only for a very short time, but it's part of Hitchcock wanting to get himself in the picture, that it's an Alfred Hitchcock film, and that he wants you to appreciate him as the creator. And he did say that he thought that directors were not treated as well as they should be, and everything he did was about trying to get them appreciated. And what we want to do is to get people back into cinemas to see these films as they've never been seen. We've gone back to the original camera negatives of some of them. We've gone back to the oldest available prints. And some of them, at least one, we've discovered that the reels were in the wrong order. The Pleasure Garden, for example, the print that we have is actually 20 minutes shorter than the version we're going to be releasing to the public for the Cultural Olympiad, as the British Film Institute's part of that big event. And not only are we restoring the films with state-of-the-art digital technology, taking out the hairs and dust and scratches and putting things in the right order, but we're also making sure that they're at the right speed. And music is so important as well, that we've got new scores. Nitin Sawhney is doing The Lodger. We've got a 26-year-old Daniel Patrick Cohen, a graduate of the Royal Academy of Music, who's doing The Pleasure Garden. And it's interesting, Hitchcock was just 26 when he did the film himself. So that's a nice pairing. And we've got other composers.
They're going to hurry us out in a moment, and I don't want to let you go, but how long are the films?
The films are about 80 to 90 minutes.
So proper length.
Oh, they're the full-length features.
Is it a complete coincidence that the artist has made this great sensation at a time when you want to bring back silent films of Hitchcock?
I mean, we've been working on bringing silent films back for 30 years, but there's been nothing like The Artist in that time.
But the timeliness for you is sensational.
Well, we just want as many people to see these films as possible, because silent film has previously had something of a bad reputation, but it's really not justified. And these are masterworks which will speak to anyone in any culture in any part of the world.
You make me want to see them, and I understand that I can at the Cultural Olympiad in London, August to...
We're actually launching in late June.
Okay.
And we'll be doing a complete Hitchcock retrospective in August and September.
Fantastic. How exciting. Thank you very much.
Thank
Great
you.
To listen with you. Okay, well, Brian Robinson, British Film Institute, good luck with the work, and thank you very much for coming in. Now I'm going to be introducing a song for you. I'll dedicate this to Alfred Hitchcock. This is Glass with the song Pheromone. Up next in the coming half hour, we'll have a review of Monocle Magazine's latest issue with our foreign editor joining us. And we're going to talk about body language, North Korean style. But first, here is the news with Nick Kelly.
Thanks, Nancy. France, Britain and Germany have said they were willing to negotiate with Iran if it was ready to talk seriously about its nuclear program, hours after the European Union imposed an oil embargo and sanctions on Iran's central bank. Syria has rebuffed as a conspiracy an Arab League call for President Bashar al-Assad to step down in favour of a unity government to calm a 10-month-old revolt in which thousands of Syrians have been killed. A top Kremlin aide has said Moscow could do little more for the Syrian president, opening the door to a shift in Russia's position after 10 months of bloodshed in Syria. Fighters loyal to the ousted Libyan leader Muammar Gaddafi are in control of the town of Bani Walid, about 200 kilometres southeast of the capital, after attacking a pro-government militia base there. Four people have been killed in the fighting. Divers have found two more bodies on the capsized cruise liner Costa Concordia near the port of Italy's Giglio Island. The recovery brings the total number of bodies to 15. Croatia's accession to the European Union next year was hailed by EU foreign ministers today. Croatia is now set to become the EU's 28th member on July the 1st, 2013. Now, we've got a magnitude 6.2 earthquake which has struck off the central Chilean town of Concepcion. It happened about 2.5 hours ago at 16:04 GMT. The quake struck 50 kilometres north of Concepcion. That's 6.2 on the Richter scale. Quite strong. Egypt's Islamist-led parliament voted to appoint a top politician in the Muslim Brotherhood as the new Assembly Speaker, the Brotherhood said on its website, a choice that would have been unthinkable when Hosni Mubarak was in power. And some financial news. European stocks hit their highest close since early August today, with Eurozone banks gaining sharply following a report that France and Germany were calling for a relaxation of global bank capital rules to prevent a credit crunch. Those are the top stories here on Monocle 24.
Thanks very much, Nick. Well, each day Midori House catches up with one of our editors so we can stay in the loop on the latest news in their field of expertise. Well, today it's our foreign editor, Steve Bloomfield's turn. And Steve, we have a new magazine on the stands. I love the cover and all the talk or the main talk being featured in this magazine is Charm.
Hello.
Hello.
Yes, Charm.
Come on and
indeed.
Charm me. Charm me. I know this isn't maybe your topic, but it's a lovely...
What do you mean it's not my topic? You say I can't do Charm?
No, I think you can. But I think you're into all the heavy-duty news. But it's a really lovely take on the world and how just getting it right and being yourself and being natural and being just a little bit... having some manners.
Indeed, yes. I think it's... Hugo MacDonald will be in on Thursday to talk in more detail about the Charm Index because it comes... within his section, but there's a lovely essay by Stephen Bailey talking about charm. And as he says,
his headmaster got it wrong.
He says, nobody ever wished they were less charming. And I think it's just one of those things that it's very easy to think of, other things that are really important for your business or your lifestyle, but actually a little bit of charm can go a long way. So that's the one of the main themes for the issue, the issue number 50.
Nice, round, smiley, charming number.
We're coming up to our fifth birthday, which is going to be the March issue.
Excellent.
But in the affairs section, so at the front, we've got a really good piece from Accra. We sent Sophie Grove to Ghana to do a story about how Ghana has found oil and what that's doing for the country. It's one of the most democratic and most sort of go-getting African countries. They had a very successful election in 2008. Things tend to work there. We'll see what happens with oil, because there's obviously this issue that a lot of their neighbours suffered somewhat from having oil. So we've got that. On the oil theme as well, we've got an interview with Norway's foreign minister.
That's Sophie again, isn't it?
It is, yeah. She was here then everywhere this month.
Great.
So Jonas Gahr Støre, who's the Norwegian foreign minister. Another really interesting interview, which Alistair G, our San Francisco correspondent, did. And this is with the mayor of Houston.
Texas.
Houston, Texas.
Do you mind if I say Houston? I think it is Houston.
It is actually Houston. But the reason I know this is because I keep on getting it wrong and people keep on correcting me.
Well, we will get feedback on this.
Believe me, it's Houston,
not Houston.
And I never heard
Houston. So there. Okay. You say Houston. Okay, sorry.
Exactly.
Anyway, tell us about the mayor of Houston.
Well, what's fascinating about her is, this is Texas is oil rich. It's a conservative state, quite right wing. The governor of Texas is Rick Perry, who has not really covered himself in glory during the presidential primaries. But Houston is, obviously one of his biggest cities. But what's fascinating about Annise Parker is she's a Green and she's gay. And yet she's the mayor of Houston. And I think it's one of those stories that perhaps changes people's perceptions.
Great, nice photograph of her there.
Lovely portrait, of her sat at her desk. At her office there. So I really like that story. That's really nice. Another really nice piece from Kabul by Shashank Bengali, who's written for us a number of times before and was in Kabul for the last 3 months. So he's given us a really nice sort of view from Kabul of as the US slowly pulls out, what's really going on there.
How a little taster of that? Is it optimistic note? Or?
Sort of yes and no. I mean, I think what's interesting is looking at the amount of money that's been spent there by others. So, for example, there's a really impressive looking parliament building that's being built at the moment. 135 million euros it cost, paid for by India. So, which really sort of underscores how India and Pakistan are these two regional rivals who both would like to see Afghanistan as well,
both friend.
Like, yes, exactly, a very close friend. And I like our star leader this month as well. It's King Mohammed of Morocco, looking very dapper there.
Wonderful sketch.
Yes, yeah, as ever, the sketches are just beautiful for star leader. So yeah, no, it's a really nice mix actually. I'm really pleased with how the affairs section turned out this month. It's a, you know, we've, as ever, it's, you know, I was going to say random. It's not random. But it's quite sort of, I like the fact that, you know, if you pick the issue up, you wouldn't necessarily know what you're going to find inside. And so you've got great Q&As with Norway's foreign minister, a mayor in the
mayor
US.
The mayor in the deep south.
You've got a big story from Accra. We also sent our Hong Kong editor, Liv Levichnik, to Harbin, which is a really fascinating city in China. And she's done a great piece there. So it's a real, really good sort of eclectic mix of places that you either don't know much about,
yep.
Or you know a bit about, but we're giving you a different angle.
Lots of stories that you're just, they're not out there on anyone else's agenda, like
yeah.
ours, right?
Yeah, that's, no, exactly. I mean, that's what we're trying to do.
Well, I think big congratulations and success on this one. I took to this, I had a blowout and got stuck in my car the other day for several hours, and I had the magazine with me.
I
just thought it was
You were supposed to be
wonderful.
Presenting a show.
I know, I was supposed to be here, and I was
yeah.
not, but instead I really focused on the charm.
Excellent.
A lot of talking there about how you charm the pants off people.
Yeah, we try and be good at that here.
Yeah.
I think we do our best.
Everyone's clothed today, but lots of charm up there.
Most of us are clothed, I think, every day.
Yes, well, exactly. I'm not here every day, so I cannot report
Let me just be very clear. We wear clothes all the time in Midori House.
And very nice clothes you do, too. Thank you very much. It's really been a pleasure.
It's quite all right.
Seeing you again.
It's very nice popping in.
And it is a fantastic issue of the magazine.
Brilliant. Well, and the other editors will be in throughout the week to give you a little taste. And so whoever's hosting on Thursday will get the benefit of Hugo and his charm.
I'm sorry I won't be here on Thursday.
Oh, well. Okay. You're missing out.
Thanks so much. That's Steve Bloomfield, and you are listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. Okay, now we're going to have a song. Listen up. Here is Beck with Tropicalia. That was Beck and Tropicalia. Well, coming up on Midori House, we're going to talk about Kim Jong-un's body language to see what it tells us about what's going on in North Korea.
For a concise and sharply edited overview of the best clips, quotes, and quips of the week, tune in to The Curator every Sunday right here on Monocle 24. Hosted by a different guest editor every edition, The Curator will point you to all the programs you might have missed and is also the perfect digest to the week in world affairs, business, culture, and design. The Curator, in association with Rolex, right here on Monocle 24.
North Korea's new leader has been getting out and about quite a bit recently, and according to North Korea's central news agency, Kim Jong-un has paid a couple of visits to military units. In one photo, we see him surrounded by military personnel. He's holding hands with one of his escorts. She also has him tightly by the arm, as does the male escort on the leader's other side. Well, body language expert and author Robert Phipps joins us now by phone from Kent in the south of England. And Mr. Phipps, if you didn't know anything about North Korea at all, you might just think the leader was not really having a good time, but under arrest with such a firm escort, except for the bit of hand-holding that's going on. What do you make of this photo?
Well, good evening. You're absolutely right. If you don't know anything about the cultural differences of body language and your culture doesn't do that sort of thing, then you could take it as meaning all sorts of different things. But it's not unique to Korea. You know, quite a lot in Middle Eastern countries, Saudi Arabia, if a British gentleman was to go there or an American was to go there to do business, quite often he will be escorted by his host from the airport holding his hand.
right on, which I have seen. But just to stick on this photo for a moment, because people might find it on the internet or in their newspapers, it's like they're kind of hugging him and revering him, protecting him, but also leading him. And this woman soldier is really got her hand on his hand and vice versa.
Well, I mean, it's their cultural norm. So regardless of how it's being perceived, as far as they're concerned, all parties concerned, that's their norm, and they appreciate it. Obviously, you know, we are led to believe that they do revere their leaders, and now the new leader's taken over. He's got to make a name for himself because, you know, a couple of months ago, he was unheard of.
Right. What is the meaning, then, of holding hands? What does it tell you when you see that in their culture and others?
It's bonding. You know, like you would in this culture, you know, you might walk along with a child holding their hand. It's a protective, it's a bonding instrument. It draws you close to people. And also when we touch people, it releases certain endorphins which make us feel good. And if we don't feel good holding somebody's hand, you can normally see it in the facial expression or the rest of the body. For example, if somebody doesn't want to hold your hand, they will quite often raise their shoulders up to show the tension. They'll still hold the hand, but they'll raise the shoulders. The facial expression also will change quite a lot. So if they're smiling, it will be a false smile as opposed to a genuine smile. Genuine smiles reach the corners of the eyes. The corners of the lips turn up to meet the corners of the eyes coming down, because there are muscles in the face that only work when we are being genuinely happy. So the zygomatic muscle around the corners of the lips, you can only make that work if your smile is genuine. Otherwise, it just doesn't stay there. I'll give you a prime example. If you've ever been to a wedding or an anniversary birthday party like that, and they're taking photographs, somebody says, oh, you know, let's smile. Everyone smiles for the first photograph. Cheese, you know, no problem. But then somebody comes along with a second or even a third camera and says, hold on. And you try to hold that smile, and you'll notice that you get a little quiver in the corner of your lip where your muscle is trying to say, this is not genuine anymore.
And you can pick it up.
You can pick that up, yeah. You can quite often see the twitching at the side of somebody's lip.
When you see, say, political figures or important people from different cultures meeting each other, well, maybe we're not going to see Kim Jong-un in Washington next week, yep. But when you see cultures meet like this and there are clear differences, do you observe lots of awkward moments or funny moments?
Yeah, you can do. I mean, a couple of weeks ago, Sarkozy and Merkel were meeting over about the European economy, and the French usually go for the kisses on either cheek.
Yep.
But the Germans don't. So Angela Merkel came in with a handshake with her hand out first. He avoided the handshake and went for the kiss, but she kept her hand out. So once he'd done the kiss, then he went, he was like, ah, this is not the cultural norm for her. Then he shook her hand, which looked quite awkward because it looked like neither of them knew what the other one was doing.
And that's an odd one, isn't it? Because the two of them have become buddy-buddy.
Yes, they have. But being as, I think it was on French soil, so Sarkozy is going to go with his cultural norm as he is the host.
How do you rate people at reading body language? I mean, do you think we're very good at it or actually just have a lot to learn?
Okay. First and foremost, we all understand body language to a certain degree. You wouldn't have got to this point in your life without realizing that, you know, you just said something that's upset a friend of yours, or you've said something that makes somebody happy. You normally respond to those things automatically, unconsciously, because most of our body language is unconscious anyway, and most of what we notice is unconscious. It's only when you ask somebody, well, why do you feel like that about this person or that person, they'll say, oh, well, when I was talking to them, you know, they had their head down, their hands in their pockets, and they will start to quote you body language movements.
Yeah.
And it's that they've picked up on unconsciously, but until you ask them, they don't know what they've actually picked up on. They'll just come away with a feeling, oh, that went well or that didn't go well. So as a general rule, we all pick up on body language unconsciously. Some things are very, very conscious. You know, if somebody you're talking to friendly and you say something slightly wrong and they get a serious look on their face and cross their arms, it's fairly obvious they didn't like what you just said. But a lot of times there's a lot more subtle stuff where they might smile at you, but it might be more of a grimace, as in a false sarcastic smile. So learning to detect the differences between the genuine and the, if you like, the incongruent false smiles, that's where the key lies, and that's what my book explains, is how to observe because most people just ignore it. And they'll pick on something that happens, you know, say halfway through a meeting. Oh, they cross their arms. Oh, now they've done something that I should take notice of. No, the answer is you have to start at the beginning, because otherwise you've got no baseline for what their behaviour is in the first place.
Fascinating. Are you? We've got to go now, but I guess you're pretty good at reading body signals.
Reasonably well, yes.
Do you have any favourites right now?
What, people or...
Yeah, you,
or
yeah.
I think Simon Cowell is always a good one to watch because he just exudes confidence. But he is also an interesting one to watch when he tries to hide his genuine emotions. For example, on X Factor and Britain's Got Talent, programs like that, he will often say one thing to a contestant, but gesture with his hand, which contradicts what is just said.
We're going to keep our eyes peeled for Simon Cowell and others, but it's time for me to thank you, body language expert and author Robert Phipps. Many thanks.
Vous écoutez Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Dette Monocle 24.
Essa Monocle 24.
Das ist Monocle 24.
En a Monocle 24 target, ja.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Monocle 24 e
io Tämä on Monocle 24.
The Propojalavet. Monocle 24.
Esto es Monocle 24.
After I met on Monocle 24.
The hat at Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
You're listening to Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
The National Book Critics Circle in the United States has announced the nominees for this year's awards. They cover what the critics themselves decide is the best literature published in English in six categories: autobiography, biography, criticism, fiction, nonfiction, and poetry. And on the line from New York City right now, we have the president of the National Book Critics Circle, Eric Banks. Hello, Mr. Banks.
Hello. How are you?
I'm very well. How about you?
Good. Thank you for having me on.
It's a pleasure to have you. Now, you're a critic yourself.
That's correct.
So I want to ask you, how was the challenge this year when it came to choosing the nominees?
It's actually quite a great discussion that we have. I mean, you know, I think across the board in all the categories that in which we award, there were very strong lists of contenders. I think in particular, fiction and biography were remarkable this year.
So let's pick up fiction. It's just a guess, but I suppose, well, maybe you could tell me, most of the world's readers, are we reading fiction or is it heavy in some other direction?
No, I think so. And I think that the list of titles that that we've nominated as finalists for the Fiction Award this year are incredibly diverse and a really interesting set of books. They really do come from a lot of different directions and speak to a lot of, I think, readers' interests from, you know, across the board. We have an older writer named Edith Perlman, who's a finalist this year for her short story collection, Binocular Vision. But we also have a first novelist in Teju Cole, who's written a wonderful book called Open City. I think that there's a lot of diversity in the list, and I think that what I find as we discuss these books over the course of the year is that a lot of people are actually deeply invested in reading fiction. I don't think that that's changed to the extent that most people think it's changed.
That's two. Let's just read the other three names out for that list. Would you like to do it? Alan Holling. I can say I'm reading Alan Hollinghurst, The Stranger's Child, myself right now, page 70-something, so I know that one.
It will change dramatically over the course of your reading. Alan Hollinghurst, The Stranger's Child, Jeffrey Eugenides' book, The Marriage Plot, and a wonderful book by a writer named Dana Spiotta entitled Stone Arabia. One of the things I should point out about our list, which I think is always interesting about the National Book Critics Circle finalists, is that it's open to a book that was published in the United States in the last year, in 2011. So that means that probably unlike some other awards in the United States, we end up having a fair number of English writers reflected on our list, but also and represented on our list, and we also have a number of books each year in translation. I think this year there may only be one in translation, but that's one thing I think that makes the NBCC Awards unique.
Another unique thing is you don't hand out cash prizes.
No, we don't. We are very much of a bootstrap organization. It's an all-volunteer organization. I mean, you have to be admitted to the National Book Critics Circle, but it comprises roughly 600 working critics, working book reviewers, and also the editors from several book review sections in the United States. We do everything, you know, pretty much from the seat of our pants, and we don't offer cash prizes. But we, you know, we're happy to say that I think it's one of the award-granting organizations in the United States that does garner a lot of attention, particularly from writers. I think writers are really proud to be on the NBCC's list.
Well, it's rather refreshing, too, to know of such an award of distinction that doesn't carry cash with it.
Yeah, I guess we should advertise that, the cashless prize. But
we refuse to give money.
exactly.
Well, we're going to hear who won in the various categories in March?
That's correct. March 8th is when we announce our winners, and that's, again, in six different categories. We have five nonfiction titles, five in autobiography, biography, criticism, poetry, in addition to fiction. And we'll be announcing that on March 8th in a ceremony at the New School in New York. That's actually a ceremony that's free and open to the public. We hope that anyone who would like to attend would come by. Also on March 7th, all of our finalists will be present for a reading of their work on a kind of marathon evening that we do each year.
That's fantastic. I need to wrap up now, but I want to thank you very much. Look forward to seeing who the winners are and to people being introduced to new books they may not have come across before. Eric Banks, president of the National Book Critics Circle, thank you so much for joining us.
Están escuchando Monocle 24.
Добро пожаловать, Monocle 24.
Esse é Monocle 24.
Monocle 24 is.
Det Monocle 24.
Das ist Monocle 24.
Det her Monocle 24.
That's it for today's edition of Midori House. Our show is produced by Marcus Hippie, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco, and our studio manager was Andrew Carter. Well, in 3 hours, it's going to be the Monocle Daily. That's at 2200 London time. I'm Nancy Durham. Bye-bye.